Everybody, and welcome to the Geek Actually After Show for the 28th of August 2010. I had to think about that for a moment there. This is episode 98. We are only
it's the end of the day, man.
It is the end of the day. It gets really long after a while, especially the film show. It was so long today that it feels like we're not finished yet. Two more episodes till the 100th episode, so it's getting kind of exciting. We're building up to that. I am Dave McVeigh, and we're still here, we're still going, and this is the Geek Actually After Show. It's our unstructured after show for our network. Basically, we've been through our tech show, we've been through our film show, and now basically we throw the rule book out the window, keep the mics rolling, and just see what happens. And I am joined...
You swear at you and say boobies a lot.
We did that already.
Oh, wait, that was the film show.
We did that in the real
show. Damn!
And I am joined, these voices you're hearing from the other side of the table, Josh Philpott. How are you?
I'm still fantastic.
Still fantastic. You're starting to look towards the tired zone.
Yeah. But it's always the third show. We don't need to be 100% professional now. Not that we ever were.
No,
but
we're never 100% professional. Callum Austin Wilson, still with us. I didn't think you'd be here for the after show, but you're still with us.
I am.
You are. And for those who are watching live, we have this really awkward looking wide shot on you guys, because we don't usually try and put three people into a shot, but we also have Shane Gregory. Yeah. Shane Gregory is still with us as well. So we've got a full house for the after show. And basically, for those who have never listened to a Geek Actually podcast before and you've just come into this one, I'd say pause this and go and listen to Tech Actually and Film Actually first.
Also because that means that we can get more hits.
Well, there's that too. And then come back to this, because this really isn't a real show. This is kind of like a bonus thing we do, where we just kind of chit-chat about whatever is around at the time. And we kind of just make it up as we go. And sometimes the shows are only half an hour. Sometimes they're 45 minutes. It goes for however long it goes for, basically. And I just got to say, straight off the bat, though, guys, I want to say I saved this for this. It was actually kind of in the tech show, and then the tech show was looking like it had a few too many things, so I threw it here and just said that Facebook has decided that they own the term book. Well, this all came about because a group called teachbook.com has come up, and they're a conglomerate of teachers who have a site where they share ideas and, you know, lessons and all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And Facebook has taken them to court, saying you can't use the term book. The term something book, so plus book, Facebook is saying no, it would dilute our trademark. The idea of adding something book, and so they're saying you can't use that. Facebook, it's only book. What do you think about this?
Well, I can't imagine a lot of other uses for the having something book without it being associated with Facebook, so,
or sex book or porn book or
are those things?
They are, apparently. I see them on Google ads.
I think it's funny that none of those are getting taken to court first. We go straight for the school teachers. We always go straight for the school teachers.
You gotta hit up the school teachers, man, because, you know, they don't do good work.
Wait, no. Are we still talking about porn or what?
So I just look at it and go, oh dear, really? You think that we've seen this before? Where have we seen this before? We have seen this with Microsoft. Microsoft took the Linux distribution to court, that was called Lindows, because the idea of Lindows was to create a Linux distro which was very Windows-like, so that people who are using Linux could have that Windows experience. Microsoft took them to court saying you cannot use the term Lindows, it's too close to Windows, and they lost. And in fact, not only did they lose, and this is the part that I love, not only did they lose the case, but the judge actually said, by the way, while we're at it, you know that trademark you have for the term Windows? I think that's now been called into doubt.
Yeah.
Because the term Windows is too generic.
Mm.
And so now Microsoft has to defend its own trademark because a judge has now said, I don't know if that trademark is legal. So
owned.
Yeah. So much for defending your trademark. Now, there is an argument, there is a legal argument that says you should always have to defend your trademark no matter what. So if you have a trademark and somebody infringes on it, you have to defend it. Because if you don't defend it, then you could be seen as not defending it and it could just be given away. Right, so there is this argument in legalese, which says that if somebody if somebody infringes a trademark, you have to defend it, even if you don't want to. So this could be a case of that, but this just feels mean spirited to me. The Facebook one just feels mean spirited.
Again, what he did say was an interesting point, though, which is the fact that there isn't really that many other uses for the word. So it's like it's an obvious rip of Facebook. So I mean, like,
To their defense, and I will say that in the article that I read this in, which was I believe news.com.au. They actually said that they've been sitting there scratching their heads for a couple of days because Teach Book seem like a really, really appropriate term. You know, teachers, books, you know, they teach things out of books, you know. It wasn't like they were trying to steal something from Facebook. It was, this is kind of just what they thought would work. And they're kind of baffled by the whole thing. I mean, they don't really think, and this is the argument, do you think people really get confused between Facebook and Teachbook?
Well, no.
It's not like the keys are near each other. No. Accidentally go to Teachbook.
And I don't think it's going to dilute their brand at all, because it's not like it's a massive social network. It's just teachers.
It depends how much Facebook want to be dicks about this. And as they've shown in the past, they do like to be dicks.
They are run by
the biggest dick of them all. Now, the question is this. When Google Me, the rumored Google Me launches, this Google Facebook clone... Do you think Apple is then going to take them to court and say, no, that's too close to mobile me?
Depends if it has the same...
I think it comes down to...
Depends if it has the same features as mobile me, if it's very similar.
Yeah, I'm just worrying about... Because, I mean, this obviously doesn't have the same features as Facebook, but they're being done for the name alone. And I'm wondering, does this mean that Apple is going to have to defend the mobile me brand? We're all pondering and scratching our heads now.
Well, yeah.
Autonomous in our chat room says, sounds like an intentional ripoff to me. And Clara Tungle has said, it's just a damn name. I agree. Damn straight. It's just a damn name. Who cares? All right. Josh, damn it.
Talk to me.
Have you gotten through any more Cronenberg films yet? We're supposed to be talking about Cronenberg films in the after shows.
Could I make a point?
No. Go for it, Callum.
That thing that you wrote about Videodrome.
Here we go.
I had never seen Videodrome before, and I had never seen Videodrome, and I read that, and I was like, oh, this sounds interesting. I'll go see it. I thought it was nonsensical shit.
Wow.
I thought it was bad movie.
Stop. We need you to defend that statement. Come on, let's do this. All right, Josh.
Okay, I don't remember.
At the start, I was like, I'm kind of intrigued what's going on. I want to know what's happening with Videodrome. Ooh, it's weirdness. So he's fucking his TV. Odd.
Actually, to be fair, he was kind of fucking his TV with his head.
Yeah.
It was whatever. It was sexual, all right? And a TV. Towards the end of the film, it just got so stupid, and it was just made so many leaps in... It went from being intriguing and weird to just being dumb and just assuming... Like, they were like... It was badly put together, I thought. And then
me any points yet. You've just said that...
We've had stupid...
Yeah, come on, let's get into
the entire second half of the film was... badly
and you
written.
All need to get closer to your mic.
The entire second half of the film was badly written and made no sense. The ending. What happened? Tell me what happened. Explain to me the ending.
Should we do this on show? Mm-hmm.
I'm curious.
Do you know what happened at the end?
Well, I would like to think. I mean,
spoilers for Videodrome.
Yeah, exactly.
We're not gonna shy away from this.
It's
but the film is
spoiling it.
30 years old now, close to it. So just bear with us. If you haven't seen Videodrome, shame on you. But you know, anyway,
it's one of those films
you're not missing
where
much.
The thing I want to say straight out is, it's a difficult movie because when you say that, the only reason I'm not straight off answering is that I don't know where to start back in the story to kind of say, well, where are you? Like, what, where did it lose you? Like,
no, I was enjoying it for the first third, shall we say.
Okay, but
the second third, I was like, I'm confused, but I'm hoping this will resolve itself. And then when he started shooting people and having videotapes put in his chest, and then that guy, he shot the guy up on stage and he just bubbled into nothing. And then he goes to a random, he goes to, well, like a dock and then goes into a boat for no fucking reason.
He's been used as, and then, like basically the video signals that have been sent, we find out at about the 3-quarter mark, have been used to basically make him like a weapon against...
They've turned him into an assassin. Yeah, whether or not, whether or not the person really is bubbling up, or whether or not he does have a vagina in his stomach that he's storing a gun in,
yeah,
is left up to interpretation. Is this in his mind, or is this reality? That's a whole different issue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But he is being programmed by a pirate signal coming through the video signal, and he's being turned into this virtual assassin, basically.
So basically,
yeah, I'm sorry, like, that's too much of a leap from... This is a movie about snuff films and...
But that's where it like starts.
That. Yeah,
because the idea is that...
they needed to get someone that was interested into... Videodrome is the name of the movie.
Videodrome is the film. Sorry, we don't have any graphics for it because I wasn't expecting a conversation on Videodrome. But it was... Look, the concept of the film is that this pirate signal, which shows this very, very extreme stuff, basically entices a certain type of person to want to watch.
Yeah.
Those certain type of people, they are assumed that their signal can then get through to, that can then reprogram.
Exactly.
So,
and these are the people...
Not everybody is going to watch that. And if some people are going to go, oh, that's not for me, and turn it off, they're not going to get basically indoctrinated into this thing. But he is of that kind of mind where he basically goes, this is just, I need to know more, I need to know more. He delves into it to the point where he does start to basically be... infiltrated by the signal that then turns him into this assassin.
It's no longer the concept of him sort of being enticed with it. The second that he starts making contact with it is where it starts going inside.
That's right. And the actual snuff movies and stuff and that whole subculture is basically just the entire... It's the enticement to bring him in.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's all very valid. But I'm sorry, it made too many leaps, in my opinion, in story to just nonsense at the end. Him killing himself, the girls in it.
Well, that's just because like it's like the whole concept of like a programmed assassin, like be it of any type of thing, like any movie you've ever seen, where basically they condition someone, or you mentally, you know, screw with someone's head, or whether or not it's sort of infiltration from mind to mind, or whether it's chemical substance or whatever. The whole thing is afterwards, the best thing that you can do with someone you have complete control of is get rid of them, and that's what they do. So he kills himself. So
yeah,
basically,
he does the job.
Whether or not
the
gore and stuff like that is a matter of interpretation. That's whether or not you want to believe this is shit's actually happening, or whether this is all just in his head. Because the reality is, he shoots someone, right? He gets out of there and then goes and sees a video signal where there is a gun there for him.
Whereas,
and
one of the ways that they program is these hallucinations. They make him believe what he is seeing, so therefore he thinks he is part of that equation. He may not have the gun forming to his hand. The guy may not have all the tumors and burst out of his body when he gets shot. That's up to interpretation. That's up to Cronenberg just messing with your mind, you know?
Yeah.
But the story itself is, once you delve past all that, is actually quite a clear-cut story.
I had to watch it at least twice or three times before I actually got what it was trying to say. Like, the first time you watch it, it's all about the shock value. It's all about the fact that you're seeing him whip a TV in the middle of a freaking room. Like, I mean, obviously, all of that shit is completely in his head because he vanishes from the location he's in and goes inside somewhere else. Like, this is all inside his mind.
The question I've got about that film, because I've never been able to quite work this out, was
I've got more than one.
Was Deborah Harry in on it, or was she also seduced into it, or was all that just in his head?
There's no way for me to actually answer that, because she shows up beforehand, before he actually...
But was she planted there? That's it.
Exactly.
And was he the specific target of the whole thing because of his position in the station?
They bring that up at about the...
Yeah, but once again, they're bringing it up, but is that just his mind playing that, or do you think it was really...
No, for the film to work, for the storyline to actually go somewhere, there needed to be... That had to be a reality, right? Her,
Because he had access, and that's the thing. He had access.
The whole question of whether she ever shows up again realistically, or whether that was just his mind's interpretation of her coming back, right? Yeah. Is actually where you can actually start going, well, what is the reality of that situation? Mm. Because the truth is, it could just be his mind, because like there's very little conversation point outside, because remember when he sees her on the TV, it's one of those situations
we put where Callum to sleep.
Sorry. Well, again, it's a movie with a lot
this
of
is a lot of yeah there's a lot of interpretation.
Josh is right though, it is a film
I
that
think it takes too many leaps in storytelling, and it just I descends the story into itself. Cronenberg going fuck a TV.
I think I think there was part of that though. I think there was definitely Cronenberg in his heyday, it's not even so much anymore, but in his heyday, he did things for shock value.
No, he dude, really, he still does, man. That scene in Eastern Promises, in the bathrooms,
yeah,
again, shock value.
And there's but also the, there's also the guy's face being blown off in History of Violence. And then he dwells on that shot.
I think those are both fantastic movies.
Yeah,
right?
But he may have...
And he's not going... shock value for the sake of
but he's learned
shock value. He's going, this is shocking because of the subject matter, and it is because it's part of the story. It naturally comes out of the
he's
story.
He's a very different filmmaker than he was back then as well, though. Yeah, if you look at all of his early films,
I think he's better because he's not doing that. I'm a shock director. I'm going to shock you.
But the thing about Cronenberg that I've always admired, even when he was incredibly into shock, he was also incredibly cerebral. Every one of his films had some sort of underlying message to them. Mm. Even Scanners, Josh and I have talked about Scanners before. Scanners has that underlying storyline, which is if you screw with what is natural, this is you could have these subverted effects.
Yeah,
in the case of Scanners, it was about thalidomide babies and the concept of we gave these untested drugs to women and the babies came out deformed, right? Mm-hmm. And then didn't take responsibility for our actions. In Scanners, they took drugs while they were untested drugs while they were pregnant, and of course ended up giving birth to telepaths who became a danger to the national safety, right? Mm. Or so that was perceived. If you look at Rabid is basically about uncontrolled disease control, because it's all about, you know, this woman who gets this disease with this killer creature under her armpit.
Mm.
And so he was very into these sort of weird concepts. But underneath his weird concepts, underneath his strange, almost slightly surreal form of filmmaking, even all the way up to Existence, which still has that kind of surreal feel to it, and even through to his more grounded films like Crash, which Crash is one of those films where there's nothing surreal in it in the sense of there's no strange creatures or, you know, weird vagina stomachs and all this sort of stuff, but it's still this very surreal feeling. These characters are so odd that they would get off on these car accidents and so forth, that you sit there and watch and go, Cronenberg has his mind where he sits there and goes, how can I tell a story, but at the same time make it in a visually interesting way that people go, I'll accept your point of view, but at the same time, we have this multi-layered effect of a film. And
Videodrome was the same for me, because, I mean, like, underneath all that, whether or not you like the story on top, like, I mean, the concept, even at the time, like, I mean, nowadays it may seem dated, but if you look at the actual depth of what he was trying to say, the idea of having these homeless locations for people that had TVs, just because we, in Cronenberg's mind at least, we had this connection apparently later on in life where TVs were actually kind of something we had to have. Like, it was broadcasting a signal
and funnily
we had
enough,
to take in.
And very prophetic, because if you actually look at the world now, most houses have one or two or even three TVs in the
houses. Exactly, and then Facebook and stuff like that, that kind of constant need to be in contact with people and so on and so
forth.
Said it was perfect.
Videodrome is that it has dated in the sense of the technology, but the concept that he's attached is timeless, in the sense that he's talking about, you know, pirate video cassettes. Fine, we no way would this happen now, but online video, online social networks, you know, Twitter zombies out there who are just attached to these screens constantly. World of Warcraft junkies.
Oh, yeah.
Who sit there nonstop living that life. And you sit there and go, his message that he was getting across was so poignant. Mm.
Even if you look at the way that sort of things like Facebook and stuff with even games and stuff like that, it's like, we're forced into this kind of world where we have to do what we're told.
And you have to interact.
And you have to be at a certain place at a certain time and do certain things. It's like, that's like stage one of mind
control. Well, social gaming is probably the perfect example of that. You're absolutely right. Mm. Something like Farmville, where not only do you have to be in there every day to do your crops, but then you have to interact with everybody else who's having a farm. So you have to give them gifts. They give you gifts. There's this constant give and take. Mm. You are absorbed in this world.
And then you start giving them the money. Money to get parts, money to get things, like real dollars and stuff like this. This is like stage one.
So Videodrome has the definite disadvantage of, over time, definitely dated because of its concept of this technology.
And I agree with Cullen to the point where I say that the story does need a lot of work. I mean, the first time I got to the end of the film, I was like, what the shit just happened? I fucking have no idea. Look, I mean, after watching it a few times, I've made my own decision on what I think he was trying to say. I'm not saying it's perfect again. My review is entirely based on my personal opinion of what I think of the film. But the idea that I've managed to pull out of it and the things that I've managed to make a decision out of, what I think the story is about, I actually really enjoy. So, look, I mean, again, it's a matter of perception, and Cullen doesn't
Things about the messages and World of Warcraft and Pavlov's level 19 dwarf paladin. Cronenberg does have a lot of messages in all his movies, like Fly, and all of them have an underlying
absolutely, and a lot of his messages are really anti-technology.
Yeah. Mm.
He really does have a thing where if you look at The Fly, you look at Videodrome, you look at Scanners, they're all beware of technology.
Mm.
I think in terms of basic storytelling, I'm of the feeling that if I watch a film and I get to the end of it and I go, that was fucking nonsensical, that made no sense, if I have to watch it again or three times just to piece together some sort of thing about the story, then that's bad storytelling, as far as I'm concerned.
I don't know whether it's bad storytelling. I think it's just
watching it again and then getting different meanings or different takes, I'm all for that. That's good storytelling, because that makes you want to revisit something because it's well thought out. But just putting a bunch of randomness together and then afterwards
I wouldn't go as far as random, dude.
It's a pretty fucking random movie.
Or you could look at it this way. You could look at it and say, I have a very hard pill to swallow.
Yeah.
Right? So, because essentially, it is a very hard pill to swallow. So what I do is I coat that in a lot of visual eye candy. Okay, and the idea being that you are so overwhelmed by that, then you'll want to come back and experience that again. Now, hopefully, if you are taken by the eye candy and you do come back for the second viewing, on the second viewing, you'll pick up the story more than you would have on the first
time. Well, look, I mean, I put it in the same class as things like Mission Impossible 1, which I needed to watch about 5 or 6 times before I got what happened in that film, because the story is so
convoluted.
And it's very convoluted, and there's scenes where you're going, well, wait, why did that happen, because that guy was over there, and it's like, you, until the second time, because the first time is the same situation as this movie. When you watch it that first time, you're just like, holy shit, explosions, dude sitting on the front of a train blowing up a freaking helicopter in a tunnel. Like, I mean, there was so much in that movie that was kind of diverting your attention away from the storyline, that when you actually got to the storyline, you were like, okay, I'm going to need to go back and try and figure out what that is. Did that fail as a movie on the first approach? Maybe he's right. Maybe it did. Because, I mean, like, if you're missing the story, a movie is supposed to be a 2-hour piece of information that you are supposed to watch in one go. But the thing, I don't have a problem.
Mission Impossible is a complete storyline. Like, just because you are, like, you're like, explosions, and you miss a plot point, doesn't mean it's a fault of the movie. It's all there. All the information is there. The thing that I don't like about Videodrome is that it's not all there. And you guys have obviously, like, seen it more times than I have.
Yeah.
And put more of your own thoughts into the film.
There is also one other factor, which is that Cronenberg films are always a little bit like that. I don't know if you've seen The Naked Lunch in particular. The Naked Lunch is out there based on William S. Burroughs' book.
The book is out there.
And he actually made it even more palatable than the original book. Because I've read the original book. The original book is even more nonsensical than the film is. But even under that, if you watch The Naked Lunch a few times, there is something there. And you start to watch it and you start to go, okay, yes, it is a drug-induced hallucination, yes, but there is substance underneath that surface. Mm. There is a core of a story. I think making people work for a film is not necessarily a bad thing.
And I don't think, there's anything wrong with having a story that is subjective. Like, I mean, I think that the very concept of that, like, I mean, it may be different to standardized film, like standardized way of watching film, but I'm not always into a film just to get a start, middle, and end in a story.
No, and there are films I want that. But there are other times where you can be taken on that ride.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is, to me, what that film is. It's like, I do really like those films. Like, there are a lot of films that I watch where I get that kind of feeling, where I get to the end of it and I'm like, all right, I didn't quite get... He sits somewhere between Lynch, which I think is far too much. We've spoken about this.
Many times.
And I think Lynch goes too far because Lynch's stuff is just literally has absolutely no point. Like, even the story gets lost in its own fucking message sometimes. Because there's just not, like...
Well, sometimes I think Lynch is just there about the image. He's not about the story.
Exactly. Either. And, like, I mean, that's a totally different type of filmmaking. And I need some sort of a story because I need to have a reason for me to sit down and watch a whole 2 hours of it. I mean, otherwise, I may as well go down to an art gallery and stare at a screen where there's loud breathing and images moving every 2 seconds. I'm not watching it for art. I was watching it for a movie. And I think Cronenberg's are still movies. But there is kind of that level of...
There's also... There's been that terminology... There's been that terminology argument for a long time, which is what is the difference between a movie and a film? Mm. And I think this is where that argument could come up really well. I think a movie is The Expendables. I think a movie is Piranha. You know, you sit there and you go, you choose some popcorn, you watch a movie. I think a film is something else. A film is where you go there to think. You go there to experience some art. You go there to whatever it might be, right? And I think... that John Badham actually used to put on his films things like Stakeout and Blue Thunder and stuff. If you ever watch him, he actually used to put at the beginning of his films a John Badham movie. He never tried to pretend like he was making fine art. He was making, you know,
movies,
you know. I think Cronenberg makes films. And I think
it also is down to the period of time you watch it, because, like...
Exactly. I was about to say, Cronenberg in 1982, I think it was, 83, whatever it was.
If you watch that film and there had been nothing like it, like, I mean, we're talking about the start of Lynch's shit as well. Like,
Lynch had only done two films at that point.
Exactly. Cerebral filmmaking was just, it wasn't there yet.
When Videodrome came out, it disgusted people. When Videodrome came out, everybody was right. I remember when Videodrome came out. And it was, everybody was like, oh my God, this is the most horrendous thing I'd ever seen in my life. This was just disgusting. I mean, people were vomiting in the cinema. It was just, nobody had seen anything like it. Mm. And you got to ask yourself, did Cronenberg do that on purpose? Yeah. You know?
Oh, yeah.
You know, Cronenberg put all of that in there to get it in your face and basically say, you're going to watch this. You're going to be forced to watch this.
But the reason I give it credit, man, is because, like, I mean, we can argue till the cows come home. And I respect your opinion. That's my number one thing I'm saying here. The reason that I still look at that movie and I accept it, even though there are a lot of flaws and holes in it, is because I look at what Cronenberg's done and I go, this man does know what he's doing. So when I'm looking at it and going, oh, well, maybe subjectively what he was meaning by that was this, I can think that the man obviously put it together with some idea of what he wanted in it. It's not just some dude going, now we'll have a vagina in his chest, and now we'll have...
That's how Lynch makes movies.
Exactly. And it doesn't have that kind of nonsensicalness.
I was exaggerating a little bit when I said that, but I think it's... I like David Cronenberg movies. I like...
The Fly is one of the greatest films ever.
Crash, I like Naked Lunch, I like The Fly, I like... But this one, I thought it just left too... It was just too...
It is what
I would love to sit down and watch it.
Like, I have different... Obviously, I expect a different thing from a film than you guys do when you're going to see something like this. And I expect solid storytelling, which is very broad. It can be solid storytelling in any... sort of facet, but I think that this particular film...
I would love to sit down and watch it with you again.
Huge gaps in how far he was expecting you to come to him as opposed
now, to be fair to you, understanding that it is one of his most confrontational films. Mm. Videodrome is probably one of the most misunderstood films and one of the most controversial films of Cronenberg's career, okay? I don't think he has another film... Even Naked Lunch didn't get... the kind of controversy that came over Videodrome, because a lot of people just kind of went, what the fuck is it? You know? And so, yeah, and as Josh said, repeated viewings, but a lot of people weren't going to give it the repeated viewings. And so, yes, it was commercial cinema, whereas if you look at a lot of his more recent films, they are more art housey. Videodrome was aimed at mass market. Videodrome opened in Hoyt cinemas. It opened mass market, and the mass market wasn't ready for it.
No,
you know, and
it, this is it, not a film I would.
The film got cut. It got banned in some places. It was just out there, and Cronenberg actually says, if you read anything about Cronenberg, he didn't work again for a while after Videodrome. Nobody would hire him. Because it was basically like, this is the guy who did Videodrome. Whoa. Even though he had Scanners, even though he had Rabbit, even though he had, what was the Jennifer Connelly film he did? Anyway, whatever that was called. He had those films under his belt. Videodrome almost killed his career. What dragged him out was The Fly. And he basically turned around and did The Fly, and everybody went, this is one of the most amazing filmmakers who ever lived. And Videodrome got an all new life because of The Fly. So The Fly saved his bacon in so many ways.
I'm going to say one more thing about this.
Sure.
The fact that I got to the end of that movie and I was like, what the fuck? And I wasn't particularly, like, I've seen a lot of movies, like confrontational films, and I wasn't particularly shocked by the confrontational imagery, but I got to the end of the movie and I was like, I wouldn't watch that again, because by the end of it I was like, I'm bored, because I have no fucking clue what's going on. I wouldn't watch it again. I would watch The Fly again. I have watched it loads of times.
I wouldn't have given Videodrome the credit that I did unless I had already seen, which I had seen Existence, which is basically the same film.
Existence, too, but it's Existence.
Existence is basically a remake of the same film. It has the same way and pretty much the same ending. Same,
but The Poor Cousin, though.
The Poor Cousin for sure, but by watching that film, I said what he said. I said I would never watch that film again. I have no fucking clue of what happened. I then watched Videodrome because I had had the one exposure of the film. When I went and watched that, I was looking more behind than I was in front of the film. And I think that was why I got a little bit more. Then because of that, I was a little bit more intrigued and watched it again and started to get it. If I hadn't have seen Existence, I think I would have given almost no chance to Videodrome. So to be fair, that's probably
And I actually really didn't like Existence very much, because Existence and just went, that's The Poor Cousin to Videodrome. And it's a territory he had already walked. And I just felt like Cronenberg never repeated himself. And so he walked the same territory again. And it's like, then why? We don't need that.
It's not surprising that he's remaking his own Fly.
Well, that's the rumor. We haven't heard any more about it since then. I would hope that that doesn't actually happen. But what's really interesting about Cronenberg, though, is that from The Fly onwards, he took a very, very different turn. He's not the same filmmaker he was prior to The Fly. Completely changed the style of Cronenberg's films. All of his previous films had kind of this, I'm going to say, strange Canadian feel to them, because he was a Canadian filmmaker. They've got this kind of slightly offbeat, odd sense, in the case of Videodrome, very offbeat, odd sense to them. And then you look at The Fly, which is a very grounded, very clear morality tale. And from there, you've got things like Dead Ringers, and which is, you know, basically a true story about these twin doctors. And, you know, M. Butterfly, and, you know, History of Violence, and with the little detour that was Existence, all of his films are very different to what they were prior to The Fly. And you're right, I think it's actually a good thing. I think he became a better filmmaker. I think the experience of Videodrome was actually good for him, because basically what happened was he realized that his style was not going to win him any friends. And I think what had happened was he hit gold with Scanners. Scanners was a huge hit in the early 80s. Thought he could do anything basically. Did Videodrome, realized that his career was mortal, was in danger, and he turned around and has produced better films since that time.
I think History of Violence is incredibly underrated.
I think History of Violence is an excellent film. I think it's a terrific film. I think my favorite The Fly, I have to state for the record, The Fly is one of my favorite films of all time.
Absolutely.
I have seen The Fly so many times I couldn't even count. I just think The Fly, I saw it when I was in film school, and it really just struck a chord with me. I saw it like 7 times in its first run at the cinema, and I've seen it multitudes of times on video, DVD, and so forth. I just love, I think Jeff Goldblum was never better than in that film. Gina Davis was never better than in that film.
Giant man fly? Never better.
Never better. Oops, sorry. Cronenberg's writing was never better than in that film, and his directing has been never better than in that film. I think that is like the absolute goalpost of any Cronenberg film is got to be measured up to after that. But I have loved some of his other films. Dead Ringers, I think, is a terrific film. Dead Ringers is actually a really thought-provoking film, and I remember seeing Dead Ringers at the cinema. Jeremy Irons, never better as an actor. And just kept walking out of Dead Ringers feeling slightly dazed by the time I walked out and thinking, Jesus Christ, you know? But very clear. Unlike Videodrome, its story is very clear. It's just, it's a hard pill to swallow, you know? And yeah, so I think Cronenberg is a very, very interesting filmmaker. He's one of my favorite filmmakers. I look forward to Cronenberg films because I go,
like,
there's something
it's
here.
It's interesting, though, because, I mean, like, I wrote that piece just because when I watched that film, I think it's a bit like, to me, like being really into a musical artist and kind of when you've sort of, because, I mean, like, you had showed me a couple and I got History of Violence and so on and so forth, and I've been watching a lot of Cronenberg films at the time because we had this big tour and we said we were going to do this, and then you gave me Scanners and I watched that. And, like, I mean, after rewatching Videodrome, that was when I said to you, and you remember, I said to you, I'm like, I don't know how to do this review.
I remember.
I can't do this review because I can't figure out what to say.
And brave of me, I couldn't review Videodrome. Because it's easy to talk about it where we have 45 minutes to talk it out. But to sit there and succinctly put it on paper, I couldn't do that. I don't think I could do it with any Cronenberg film. He's a hard person to write about.
Exactly. And I mean, like, I wrote it, and, like, I mean, I was happy with what I wrote, and, you know, it was, in my opinion anyway, I mean, I'm not putting words
in it. No, I liked it. No,
It was a good enough piece, but the interesting thing is, after watching all of those, it's a bit like the musical artist situation, whereas it's kind of like I've listened to all that they've done, and it's kind of like it's the album that no one likes, but you kind of understand what they were trying to do and where they were going.
Yeah, right. It's his experimental album.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that's all I can say about it. It's like, yeah, it's flawed. It's not the world's best film. I don't put a rating on it because, you know, I don't actually know what, you know, like, I don't know 100% that it's like the greatest film of all time, but people didn't watch it, and I still think, if you got any idea of, like, I tried to put as much into the article and tried to explain as much as I could in, like, 300 words of what it was about, just to try and entice people to go and have a look at it. Like, I mean, it won't hit with everyone.
Enticed me to go and have a look at it.
Well, there you go. And look, it's not to everybody's taste. All right, we've got to be very clear. Videodrome is not to everybody's taste. It is disturbing. The imagery in it is disturbing. Even, you know, a film that is close to 30 years old, the prosthetic makeup and stuff in it is actually quite disturbing in many ways. The concepts are disturbing. The sadomasochistic snuff movie stuff is quite disturbing in its concept. It is not a pleasant film in any way. But it does boast one of James Woods' finest performances.
Oh.
I think James Woods is phenomenal in that
James
film.
James Woods is the only reason you, like, you stay there and sit in your seat.
Yeah, I mean,
the man is just, you honestly believe that he has no other part of him apart from this creepy, gross salesman-esque
kind of
feel.
I'm feeling that's what he's like in real life.
Yeah,
I'd say
because he's like that on Family Guy a lot.
Yeah. James Woods, I really like James Woods. I particularly like early James Woods. He's become a little bit of a caricature of James Woods now, but early James Woods, 80s James Woods, even late 70s, early 80s, even all the way into the early 90s, perhaps, James Woods did some really good, really interesting work, and now he's become kind of this caricature, and I think it's from about Vampires, about John Carpenter's Vampires onwards, I've kind of...
Yeah, it wasn't a great film.
No, and I've kind of... And then John Carpenter's another one where it's one of those directors who hasn't really turned in a quality film since the 80s.
Halloween.
You know? Well, after Halloween, you've got The Thing, you've got Big Trouble in Little China, Escape from New York. I mean, he's done some really good films.
I find that when he puts John Carpenter's in it...
Every film.
Yeah, but after a while, it's just... I saw, like, John Carpenter's Ghost of Mars.
Not a good film. Like, not a good film.
That should just have been Ghost.
I am actually curious to see his new film. He's been in semi-retirement for quite some time now, since Ghost of Mars, actually. John Carpenter is an aging hippie.
I would call it exile.
Sorry, that's awesome.
John Carpenter got really disillusioned with the whole industry and about everything, and really his career has been floundering for a while. And he disappeared for a long time. And he kind of made this, with Josh and I've talked about this on the show, he's made this resurgence doing this couple of episodes of Masters of Horror, which are, quite frankly, the best episodes of Masters of Horror, hands down. Yeah. The Cigarette Burns, in particular, is probably one of the finest pieces of horror.
Yeah.
One of the finest pieces of horror put on screen, film, or television
yeah.
in years. I mean, it's just...
Oh, it's
grueling.
And it has that effect where it stays in your head for yes. days after.
And you find yourself disturbed watching it. And that's yeah. the sign of a really interesting horror film when you sit there going,
well,
oh,
it's just
God,
we don't get that anymore. Flinch. Desensitization is just... Yeah.
Because our idea of a horror film today is Piranha 3D. And that's yeah. not a horror film, you yeah. know? A horror film, there's gore...
Yeah, I like Cigarette Burns. Not enough boobies, though.
We're back to the boobies.
In answer to Delta Knight's questions... Masters of Horror is hit and miss. It's very hit and miss. You watch one episode and it will just be amazing, and then you watch another episode and Heckle's you'll be tail. Like, oh, that was really average, and then you watch another episode and be like, ew, that's
just I look
just
at Masters
fucked.
Of Horror and I can say out of the 12 episodes of the first season, there's probably three.
Where really
I go,
good ones,
where I go,
but at
fantastic.
The same time...
Second season, there was a few more.
But exactly, yeah. but at the same time, over those ones that miss as well, it's not like you watch everyone and you're like, well, that was...
Some of them are just
hours.
Like poor Twilight Zone knockoffs.
Well, yeah, but I kind of like... I like that kind of a feel, because I like the fact that I sit down and I just see... It's like an experimentation,
yeah.
like, seminar. It's like they basically just went... Just make whatever you want.
Yeah, for those in the chat room or on who are listening to the audio who don't know what Masters of Horror is, it was a Showtime series. Mick Garris, who is a horror film, he's Australian, isn't he, Mick Garris? I think he might be. Anyway, but he's a horror film director. He did a lot of the Stephen King adaptation. Mm. I think he did The Stand, the big miniseries of The Stand. He basically had this idea that he said the horror was kind of falling down. He wasn't really happy with the state of horror and so forth. And so he talked Showtime into giving him this money. And his concept was to get the absolute cream of the crop horror directors from old time periods. Basically, whoever was considered a master of horror in their day, your Carpenters, your Joe Dantes, what have you. And basically give them $1 million each and say, do whatever you want. You've got $1 million, carte blanche, do whatever you want. And... So they all created these little one-hour movies that were not related to each other, but these one, and they're all very different because they're all these
absolutely.
Very different
and like you've got like you say probably three or four per season that are just fantastic, like that
Cigarette
just,
Burns.
That will just stick
Cigarette
with you.
Cigarette Burns and Homecoming.
Joe Dante's Homecoming is friggin' awesome. Yes, Joe Dante's Homecoming was actually the first episode I ever saw, and I watched it because of a review I had read on it, and they said Joe Dante was back in fine form, and although not scary, it has all of the elements of Dante. From the days of Piranha, The Howling, you know, and so forth. And it's just brilliant. It's just brilliant.
No, and I mean, that's the great thing. But even the ones that I didn't like, a lot of the time, though I may have gone, that was pretty average, when I think about it, there's a whole bunch of things that were really awesome about them or really different or unique. And that was probably one of my major selling points is being like, okay, these are just fantastic.
Yeah, it was copied.
For Haeckel's Tale.
Yeah, that one just gets written off.
I'm sorry, that's
well, there was a couple. There was also one which I cannot remember what it's called, but there was one with a girl and truck driver and like a motel. It was very much
the two serial killers.
I just felt I just sat there watching. Pick me up, thank you. And I sat there going, really? I can't remember what filmmaker it was that was attached to that one now, but it was one of the lesser ones. But
it's kind of interesting, though, because the other great thing about it for me as a massive horror fan that's seen, you know, I'd like to say a good 75% of all horror films ever made. When you watch them, it's great to kind of point out the moments from that person's, like, style. Mm. Or, like, if you're watching something as bizarre as fucking, what was the third one? Poltergeist director.
Tobe Hooper.
Tobe Hooper. And you're sitting there and you're like, this is shit, but my God, what are you thinking? Like, what goes through your head? Someone gives you $1 million and you're like, I'm going to have, zombie strip shows.
Yeah, but Tobe Hooper, you know, I look at Tobe Hooper and I go, Tobe Hooper is one of those directors where you go, your best is behind you. And you are now incapable of doing it. And it makes you wonder whether or not his best was fluked. Because you think about Tobe Hooper and you go, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is a brilliant piece of film for what it was. And then you look at Funhouse, which was a pretty okay horror film from the early 80s. Mm. Then you look at Poltergeist. Now, okay, Poltergeist is in contention.
Poltergeist, there's a lot of people, sorry, Dave, but I've made my final decision on that, and it had nothing to do with him. Every scene that I like...
Spielberg.
Every scene I dislike in that movie was his responsibility. Yeah, I agree. And I can guarantee
and
you that.
The story behind Poltergeist, for those who haven't followed the story, is, of course, Tobe Hooper and Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg wrote it and produced it. Tobe Hooper directed it, according to the credits. But Spielberg didn't direct it because he was making E.T. But apparently he was on set all the time. The stories are that they fought like tooth and nail on the set constantly, every single day. And the rumor has it that Spielberg actually directed about 90% of the film. Mm. And there are moments in it where you sit there, like with the guy pulling his face off, where you go, oh, Spielberg wasn't there that day.
Yeah,
right? Exactly. You know, and it's like...
It kind of makes bizarre jumps from kind of family-friendly into just bizarre territory.
Bizarre, that's right. And there is actually... The story goes that the film was reassembled by editors afterwards to try and piece together this mess of a film. Yeah. And they're lucky that it came out the film that it was, because it's actually... I love Poltergeist. I think it's a lot of fun. You can see really bad cuts. Mm. There's that one cut that goes from them in the kitchen to suddenly at the next door neighbor's house. And it's such a jarring cut that you sit and go, there was no footage in the middle of it. They just had nothing to cut. And there's just this jump cut.
Or that there was cuts, but they were all just really bad.
Exactly. So
I always found it very odd that it's like the... It always sticks in everyone's mind, the little girl on the screen.
Yeah.
That's obviously Spielberg, because that's fucking scary.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, he just got pulled out of his window by a tree.
Which I think is I think that's a Spielberg moment too, though, because I think that's Spielberg wrote the script, and these are all Spielberg actually says he wrote the script of all the things that scared him as a child, basically, and the things that he would do to terrify his sisters, because he used to pick on his sisters, and he rolled that into this film, which is kind of this urban ghost story, you know. Mm. And I don't think Poltergeist was ever meant to be a horrific film.
Mm.
It's one of those sort of films where you sit there and go, it's one of those campfire spooky tales, you know? And it's got moments in it which got a nice jumps in it, but overall it's not a very scary film. Mm. And, you know, but it's kind of a family-friendly scary film. Mm. It's not a horror film.
Yeah.
And I love Poltergeist. I think it's very... But we would go back to Tobe Hooper. After Poltergeist, even though he may not have directed it, whatever the excuses might be, his name was front and center on that film.
Yeah.
He could have capitalized on that. But what did he produce after Poltergeist? Life Force, Invaders from Mars, Mangler. You know, it's like you sit there looking at everything he has touched after Poltergeist has been crap. Only assume that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was
the opposite version of the Midas touch.
Yeah, I think
it's
so.
It's like he just touches things and
he has every opportunity to make them good.
Yeah.
It's not like he hasn't had the opportunity. He's had the money, he's had the resources, he's had the tasks.
He has what I call Troy Duffy syndrome, where he just likes to destroy everything he touches.
So yeah,
you know the second movie was shit. Don't try and tell me otherwise. I'm done.
Okay. Tobe Hooper is a fascinating one, and the fact that you tell me that his episode of Masters of Horror was bad, I don't doubt it for a second. You know. Even working with John Carpenter couldn't save him, because he did a film called Body Bags, which was like an anthology film, and Carpenter was involved in that. And in fact, Carpenter actually played one of the characters in it as well, because he's kind of a weirdo-looking guy. That was awful,
very
too.
Odd-looking guy. Him and Cronenberg. That man is fucking scary.
Great actor. Cronenberg, when he is put into films, plays the creepiest ass dudes I've ever seen.
Did you guys meet the Feebles?
No, I was actually... I'm thinking of To Die For, Nicole Kidman film. He plays the hitman at the end, who kind of just shows up and says, yeah, hey, nice car. And as soon as he shows up, you go, bad news, run, run, run. And he was also the...
He probably has a lot of trouble in life.
He was also the bad guy.
Why do you think
guy.
He became horror director?
Well, did you guys see Nightbreed, the Clive Barker film? He played the psychopath in that. He played the bad guy. The evil weirdo doctor guy.
Too.
Wow. And you sit there and look at it and go, I'd like to see him cast more. Because he's got that weird face, you know? Anyway. Oh, well, that completely went against... that was an interesting conversation. Nothing that we had scripted at all.
You started it. You said you wanted to talk about...
Well, I wanted to know if you'd actually watched any more, and we got back into it. But, you know, I think it needed to be said. It's good. I just wanted to have one last thing, and then we're going to get out of here.
Bye,
because
Naughty.
By Northy, because we are, you know, we're very late because we had a very long show. I just wanted to say that, you know, this ongoing war that goes between the Star Trek and Star Wars people, how they say mine's better than yours, yeah. Mine's bigger than yours, right?
I well, like the boat.
Star Wars won a round this week because science boffins have actually come out and said there's been a lot of talk for a long time. You know, the opening scene of Star Trek 6, where Praxis explodes and there's that shockwave that goes out across. Yeah. And it's a beautiful effect. Industrial Light and Magic did it. Mm. And then when a couple of years later, when George Lucas did the special editions of Star Wars, he added the shockwave ring around the Death Star. And everybody goes, oh, you're just copying Star Trek. Mm. Well, the science buffins have actually come out this week and said Star Wars got it right. And they're actually saying that Praxis blowing up in the opening of Star Trek doesn't make any sense. Because it's a planet blowing up, it would actually blow out in all directions simultaneously. There would be no grounds for a shockwave to fire out in one direction. But on the Death Star, there is, because it actually has the trench around it. So when it exploded, the pressure buildup on the inside of the Death Star would actually blow out the weakened area of the trench first, therefore creating a shockwave blast. Ah,
nerds for the win.
And there is a picture of the two blasts. And,
shouldn't these people be like curing cancer or something?
However,
this is what they do in their spare time.
This is what they do in their spare
time.
They're
allowed downtime too.
However, before we go, we'll just say that the Star Wars also got it wrong at the same time. Now, the way they got it wrong, the science boffins have actually said, is if you look at the scene very closely, though, there's the Death Star, it explodes, shockwave goes off like that. The shockwave actually would have gone off sideways because the Death Star's ring is around the center of it. So, but conceptually, it's right. But they just put the shockwave the wrong way around. And they're probably worried about being compared to Star Trek. So you can't win either way you look at it. Yeah. All right, we're going to get
the story. George Lucas left well enough alone.
Well, and the moral of the story is Industrial Light and Magic did both. So
no, I'm sorry. The moral of the story is the answer to this question is futile anyway because it doesn't matter. They'll argue it till the day we all die.
Of course.
And I'm out.
And you're out. Okay, we're going to get out of here. If you agree or disagree with us, or in particular if you've seen Videodrome or any David Cronenberg films and want to make a comment about your Cronenberg...
How much you hated them.
Or how much you hated it. Oh, and Dark Knight says not only that, but the Death Star has a lot more energy in it to explode outwards. A lot more energy than a planet?
Look...
I don't know.
Hey, again... Let's not argue this. Let's leave this to basement nerds.
All right, we gotta get out of here. We are nerds, dude. We got
to basement nerds.
We're attic nerds.
I am much more of an attic nerd.
All right. If you want to send feedback to our show, feedback@geekactually.com. Let us know what you think of David Cronenberg films in general or Videodrome specifically. You can send your comments, criticisms, anything you like to this address. And if they're interesting, we'll read them out on the show. And you can also send us a voicemail at 02-8011-3167. That is a Sydney number. I do apologize for our overseas listeners. But, you know, if you've got... Skype, it's very cheap. Okay, and Josh,
gonna do the super fast version this time.
Cool.
Which is rawdlc.com. It's awesome. Come see it. And also Delta Knight, check out next week's show because you will be getting a huge plug.
And that's I'll add it because Josh went, you got some change, man.
I suck your dick for a dog.
Oh dear. Okay. We'll also throw out a quick shout out to our friends over at the Movie Fan Cast, moviefanhouse.com. The reason why we're doing a really big shout out to them this time is because, of course, I'm going to be on their network this week, and, you know, that makes it special. I'm recording an episode of Right This Instant, which is Brad's new show, this week, and we're also going to be. At various times, a lot of us are going to be on their new Walking Dead miniseries, we hope, because it's going to be awesome. And it should definitely be listened to. You can find that at moviefanhouse.com or search for it on iTunes. And, of course, where would we be without listening to our good friends at the Real Junkies podcast, the R-E-E-L Real Junkies podcast, which you can find on iTunes, or go to weekendronan.com, because on the weekend they are their own masters. I love that concept. Anyway, they get drunk on, well, I don't know if they get drunk, but they drink a lot of tequila while they movie review, and it's a lot of fun.
When does Geek actually have drinking episodes?
We had one. It wasn't actually Geek Actually, it was Platforms.
Platforms. That went down fine. I don't know what you're talking about.
I should do that.
I like to try and stay lucid on my show.
I'm more lucid when I drink.
Are you? Okay.
He actually is. That's not even a joke. He actually gets less bizarre.
Oh, we didn't mention one thing here.
These guys?
Any of us. We didn't mention this.
No, I mean, you didn't mention these guys.
We're going to come to them in just a second. I just have to ask, because Callum actually saw the news earlier, and I said, no, that's for the after show, and we never got to do it. It's only a rumor.
It's only a rumor.
It's completely rumored. But what do you think of the idea of Brad Pitt playing, what's his name, John Masters? Is that
I think John if Masters, it had a bit of storyline, I'd care.
Fair enough. There you go.
I'll watch it if they make it. And Brad
this
Pitt's
is, by the way, for those who are listening, Red Dead Redemption, the game, they are talking about making a feature film out of it, and there is talk that Brad Pitt has been asked to play the lead character. Now, before we do anything, though, rumors are completely unsubstantial because Brad Pitt, being the A-lister star that he is, is probably offered every new male role that comes out in Hollywood. So, therefore, nothing should
he's
be thought.
He's on the automatic mailing list. Angelina Jolie probably
the automatic
as well.
Mailing list. Yeah, new film! What?
Give it to Brad Pitt and see if he says yes.
So I wouldn't.
It's easier to say no than say yes, dude. I mean, like, you know, if they get a yes, they can talk about it. If not, then they have to deal with it.
Well, if they don't hear anything, it's even easier to talk about because then it's all just rumor.
I also think there's not enough plot in that game to make a movie.
Fair enough. Callum, how can people find more about you on the internet today?
Callum Wilson Austin, spelled with one L. At Facebook, you can find me there. You can't find me on Twitter because I have morals.
Explain the Twitter bias here.
I just don't like Twitter. There's too much of that. You know the
communication, the talking.
Yeah,
you know?
People saying
no, it's not communication.
Cat. And everyone else is like, "Oh my god, I saw a cat too."
There is no communication in Twitter. It is just people posting what they're doing.
Okay, so next time Callum submits an article to Geek, actually, I shouldn't feed it onto Twitter where you get an instant.
So an advertising
hits.
Space.
Oh no, I mean, if you want to do it, but I'm not. I'm on principle. All the times that I bagged it out, if I did it now, I'd be, you know, my morals would be compromised.
Uh-huh.
Which is not going to happen.
Okay.
Anyway, www.bloodyjaw.com and on Geek Actually.
What's Bloody Jaw?
That's my site.
I didn't know yet. Why didn't you say that in the last show?
I said that in the last show.
I wasn't paying any attention.
And then the time before that, when I was on the show, I said it. You said you really liked the name.
Bloody Jaw. It's a good name. I like it.
Still.
I still like it. See, and that's the beauty of getting old. I forgot about it, so I get to enjoy it all over again.
People
are you looking for coping with senility? No, jump away. Oh yeah, coping with senility.
Shane.
Alright, Shane, how do we find out more about you on the internet?
Just type in my name, Shane Robert Gregory, into Facebook or Nexus81. And I'm also on Raw DLC, so take care.
And Shane, you've actually been quiet. Have you actually seen Videodrome?
No.
Okay, that's why you're quiet. Yeah. All right, cool. All right, if you want to find out more about me, you can find me at twitter.com/DavidMcVeigh.
Oh, snap.
And we also have a fan page on Facebook, which I do hate, but not the fan page. I hate Facebook. But you can find out. You can find us at facebook.com/geek. Actually, I tried to resign from Facebook.
No, I don't want to hear it. Okay.
Remember, this is just the after show. If you do want to hear our real shows, look for Tech Actually or Film Actually and listen to those because we have a lot of fun.
And you should listen to this one as well.
And this one as well, of course.
And Rodeo Sun.
And remember, if you want to catch us live, like our wonderful chat room, and I want to say thank you very much to the chat room, those who are left in our chat room, you can watch us record all three of our shows. We do them all in the same day. One big block. Saturday, 12 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time is when we start. I'm not going to give you individual show times because some shows run long, sometimes we run late, so it's pointless. Just starting at 12, tune in, we're doing something.
Yeah, we'll be doing something until like, what the fuck, it's 4:30. Yeah, well, Jesus Christ.
We do something until sometime late in the afternoon, all right? So, and you can catch up with that at any time. We also want to give one big last shout out before we get out of here to our friend Josh Spencer over at attackninja.blogspot.com for the wonderful cartoons he is doing for our new cover art. He has lots of artwork for you to check out. Go have a look at his stuff too because he is well worth having a look at. And if that is all there is, we are going to close this off for the day. Nothing else, guys?
Yeah, I'm going
to stand up. He's standing up. We're all tired.
Oh, God.
Thank you very much. We will see you all next week.
Bye.
Bye.
We'll be right back.